Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Martin Amis, the author most recently of Time's Arrow, published by Harmony Books, division of Crown. Author, too, of London Fields and Money. This book is narrated in reverse by a man who has been a Nazi doctor. And the first thing I wanted to ask, one of the things I've noticed, I think from the time of John Hawkes' novel, The Cannibal, writers get a certain charge out of writing in the persona of criminals, which subsequently extends to them. Have you become, you know, a wolf of the SS subsequent to writing this book?
No, that's yet to happen.
You know what I mean, though. There's a certain kind of brass that comes...
Although the criminal is has an honorable and charismatic place in society, which the war criminal doesn't quite have, and particularly the Nazi war criminal, and particularly the Nazi medical war criminal, who is 100% unappealing, I would have thought. Doesn't even have the squeaky leather jacket, you know. He is a bespectacled figure working in a back room, surrounded by his disgusting furniture and his disgusting ideas. I don't think there's any spare charisma to redound on the author there.
Nevertheless, though, I think after Kurt Vonnegut wrote Mother Night, some of that spikiness became a part of his public persona as well. I think that, you know, how to put it, the critics are so apt to find writers whose view of the world is bleak to then personify them and identify them with the bleakness of their speakers. And after a while, I think perhaps it becomes even enjoyable to be thought of as a misanthrope beyond Celine.
Beyond whom? There are a few misanthropes. I don't know. I don't look forward to it if that's inevitable. Kurt Vonnegut, you might say, was such a sort of lovable and twinkly figure that... a bit of hardening of his image probably didn't go amiss. I don't know, I think, you know, the world over and in every field, a personality, a writer, a person, is easier to get hold of than a book, let alone a body of work. I mean, it's so much easier just to think about a person. People are so much more, assimilable in that form. A book is complicated, but we all know about people.
But, I guess it was the famous comment subsequent to the publication of Portnoy's Complaint, he's a brilliant writer, but I wouldn't like to shake his hand. Mm-hmm. That inevitably, I think, you know, that writers become so much the victims of misunderstandings about them that it really does alter, if not the subsequent work, the one after it.
Yeah, well, I would say this is... you're dead right, and I've got my friend Ian McEwan. I'm sometimes asked not to leave him alone with people in the same room because they've read The Comfort of Strangers or whatever it might be and think that that there's a sort of psycho glint there, which, in fact, there isn't at all.
I've known him for around 12 years, and, you know, it's so funny that... That is the attitude. It's even true among academics who ought to know better, or perhaps, you know, God knows what they know. But that is true around Ian McEwan. It came, I think, just after he had published that short story, Psychopolis. People were afraid of being chained to their bed.
Right, or chopped up if they've just read The Innocent. but we all know this just isn't the case, that we're all, writers are all Flaubertians on the whole, with the exception of Norman Mailer and others, a couple of others, in that they are quiet and orderly in their lives, that they might be savage and original in their art. If you're too savage and original in your life, there's really nothing to write about because you're doing it all.
This book, I guess, is a very interesting case in point because, like William Gass, who's been writing for some 20 years, a book called The Tunnel about a Nazi historian who is justifying Nazi aesthetics as well as Nazi politics, this book has... Gass's argument, at any rate, is that the linguistic virtuosity of his book, that the truth of art is more important than the truth of politics, and that he wants to brush his Nazi apologist to such a fierce and brilliant burnish that one will accept the figure, if not what he says, because he says it so well. Here, too, you have a terrifying figure renamed in America Todd Friendly, whose life is now being run backwards. And the linguistic brilliance of the device of having a person not eat but redeposit his breakfast on the plate and move backward out of the house to drive backward to work. All of this acts as a palliative in some way, an aesthetic cushioning.
Well, I don't agree with you. No, it was my intention in the first half of the novel to acquaint the reader with a backwards in time world, which isn't wholly a repulsive one. It's kind of grotesque, pathetic, meaningless, above all meaningless world, where people say goodbye when they mean hello. And also it's a predetermined, it's very determinist world where people trudge out the paths they've already trudged out. But it's not without its comedy, certainly. But then when we get to the second half of the book, it's, you know, I hope that what I've been doing has been preparing the way for looking at Auschwitz backwards. And we'll see, one finds that in a backwards in time world where nothing much makes sense, Auschwitz makes perfect sense mm-hmm. when done backwards in time. Which is a way, you know, a way of going at it imaginatively, because it tells us, I think, how wrong they got it. If, and only if, it works in a backwards in time world, then it is a psychotically and perfectly inverted world. And the book is really about that if time, the size of that if. If things like Auschwitz are going to make sense, then this is how the rest of the world's going to look.
In the there are two things, in fact, that are happening in this book. It's not just that the time is going backwards, but the narrator is split. There is a voice within him who speaks the book, speaks to us for him. The only time the doctor is fully present and narrating is at Auschwitz. Otherwise, we always hear from his, perhaps, conscience or more timid alter ego.
Well, actually, it's the alter ego, the soul, or the inner spirit that narrates the whole book, including Auschwitz. Auschwitz is the only chapter where he thinks of himself as an I, rather than an occasional I or a we, or he thinks of the body he inhabits as a he. But in Auschwitz, they come together in his
right,
own
they,
mind.
They coalesce in this yeah. because the soul, whose nature is good, in a backwards Auschwitz in which the Nazis are giving life back to the corpses that are being brought to them.
Down from dreaming a race from the heavens and then putting the fillings back in their teeth, putting their hair back on, fattening them up, reuniting them with their families, and sending them back to the ghettos from which they will be dispersed to their nice cottages and homes.
Well, this is, I'm sure you began it aware of it, an enormous risk that the deviousness of the device will outweigh the feeling and morality of the revelation that Auschwitz backwards is a generous, a utopian community, and that people who've always talked about the terror of the reasonableness, the rationality of the concentration camp are right, if only it could be run backwards. There is nevertheless, despite this, the feeling as you get to those sections that one has to have, as they used to say, a heart of stone not to be moved by them. And being contemporary as we are, we almost want to defend ourselves against being moved, almost as if we were reading The Death of Little Nell again.
Yeah, I mean, I felt it was a risk, not quite for that reason, although that's certainly the lines on which people have divided about the book. I had no idea how those pages would read, and I think I do have an idea now. But, yeah, as you're right, what happens is that Auschwitz is described without emotion, really, or with mild, even more than mild, positive feelings, because it's been experienced the wrong way in time, and time's arrow is also the arrow of morality, it transpires. But what happens is that the reader supplies the emotion, because the reader knows what really happened, and the reader is, of course, constantly throughout the book reinterpreting events to see what really happened by upending them to see what way they go in a proper clockwise world. But you know, not everyone likes the book, and that was certainly on the cards when I began it, that not everyone was going to like it. I think I was more or less prepared for that. It's been true of my other books as well. But those who do say that it does make them, you know, it draws your attention to various basic ironies about the whole.
Oh, well, it's a very queasy-making book, because as you read, as I read at any rate, I found myself when I got out of bed in the morning thinking, am I waking up or going to sleep? It really does reverse one's conventional expectations of everything. And I found, I guess, the backward motion such a, you know, like any disarrangement of the senses, it was in itself so enjoyable that having to conjoin it with the notion of Auschwitz, you know, it's almost as if, you know, one wants to read a book right after this narrated backwards by Donald Duck, someone who will give you the opportunity of all of the joys of gravitylessness and none of these, you know, attendant sorrows.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's not quite the same as some of the criticisms I've had, where people talk as though, you know, the writing in backwards in time is one thing and Auschwitz is another thing, and I don't make them converge at all. That, you know, I should have done some other story backwards and done Auschwitz forwards. But I mean, the point is that it does mirror the ideology and makes the ideology true. And, you know, when we think of Nazi doctors, we think of Mengele, these seraphs of evil. But in fact, you know, almost every death in the Holocaust was monitored or overseen or covered up by a doctor. You know, survivor, colon, quote, they were all doctors. Nazism was a biomedical vision. It asked German doctors to stop healing and start killing in the name of healing.
Well, it's a fascinating thing because, of course, what seeing Auschwitz backwards does is ask us to see what this would be like had the Nazis won the war. because after all, they do want to create a race. Obviously, the race that they created was not the Jewish race, as in your book, but what was about to begin was the eugenic perfection of the Aryan. Mm. It would not have ended at the camps with the Jews, the Gypsies, the homosexuals, the dissidents, but with experiments enacted upon the gene pool itself.
Yeah. That's right, and their program was to make to heal Germany, to make Germany whole by excising what Hitler called the gangrenous appendix of Jewry. So a biocratic vision revolving around this healing-killing paradox. Now, in a backwards in time world, healing becomes killing and killing becomes healing. In a backwards in time world, excrement becomes
element,
basic essence. Mm-hmm. Putrescence becomes something that you can adore because putrescence is fruition backwards in time. Down to quite small details, like, you know, on the gates of Auschwitz and every other camp, with the words Arbeit macht frei, work makes free, work liberates. And even that becomes, you know, a gruff and undesigningly honest remark about what happens in Auschwitz in a backwards in time world. It's somehow, the inversion was so perfect that to reinvert, you know, turns a totally disgusting experience into a celebratory one. And I don't think that is quite true of other atrocities. I don't think anyone got it quite as wrong as the Nazis did.
Well, it made me, when I was reading, think most frequently, in fact, of that book by E.M. Cioran called A Short History of Decay. And in the way that in the wake of World War II, thinking men, thought is a paradoxical thing. And, you know, the body and the mind can come to learn to live with anything. And so Cioran became a delectician of decay, of deliquescence. And, you know, in answer, think, for instance, of the punks, to World War II, you become a society that has to find ways to account for, integrate, and accept events that would have been previously unacceptable. One of them is to turn them into philosophies of decay, you know, to see this as being not that we had witnessed something exceptional, but that we had witnessed something quintessential.
Mm.
Did I lose you?
You're usually way over my head.
I'll duck. Simply that, how to put it, that we've derived in this century an aesthetics of the bestial, and that in a certain way that this book is an analysis of that, of in some sense how that happened. By working in reverse, it becomes a celebration of a process that we have had, you know, by hook or by crook, the nature of man eventually, with the most horrible things, they will learn to praise them.
Well, there's nothing they won't do or can't do.
Well, I don't think it's just the baseness of man. You know, they say to Ahab, you know, what will you do? They're talking about the monstrosity of the whale. And he says, I think I'll praise it.
Yeah. But doesn't it seem to you even more striking that that's a kind of retrospective justification of what has happened? But usually the worst things get going because certain people have convinced themselves that it's good. That, you know, the Nazi doctors didn't think that, you know, here we are, 500,000 Charles Mansons having an orgy of, you know, cowardly and barbarous sadism. They thought we're doing a tough job, and we're not going to get thanked for this, but this is what is necessary, and, you know, it looks awful, but when it's done, people will see that it was necessary, that it was good.
Well, the real darkness of Time's Arrow, by Martin Amis, to whom I'm speaking, seems to me to be that when you go through this book, inevitably you are moving to pleasanter times than our own, that this would probably, unfortunately, be true whether time were literally moving backwards or not, is the nightmare that coming up with a special effects Auschwitz does not change the fact that the nuclearization of the world is something much more unimaginable than what happened in the camps, and that this narrator recognizes that when he finds himself back in the backwards ovens, he feels like a humanitarian again.
Although the nuclear reality will always be a contingent one, since if that happens, there won't be time, there won't be a world of discourse in which to write these novels that, that take it backwards or forwards in time. But Robert J. Lifton and Jonathan Schell and others have said that the Holocaust was a kind of dry run for the nuclear Holocaust, in that it's the nearest we have, and it's our closest base for trying to get a grip on the Holocaust that, if it happens, will not be discussed and not have novels written about it.
I had a question stylistically. Can you talk to me about your narrator's cigar?
You mean you noticed?
Well, of course I noticed. How could you not? This doubling of peas all over the place.
He smokes little cigars called Perfectos, which is, I think, a medium-sized cigar. And from the very first mention of these Perfectos, I think you see him smoking a pensive Perfecto. And then later on, it's a
philosophical
Perfecto. And then even at one point, a faintly paranoid Perfecto. But I did, in fact, get out my smallest dictionary and go through the P's and look for nice adjectives which I could couple with the Perfecto. But that sounds like a very frivolous thing to be doing while you're writing about the Holocaust. But in fact, I did find quite early on that style, for which, you know, I get people point at me in the street and say the word, you know, linguistic style, was actually the element that would have to give in this novel, and that there isn't, I felt I was writing prose as elegant as I could make it, actually elegant is the wrong word, a prose without false quantities, but that there would be absolutely no room for a kind of brio or pleasure in words, that there was too much going on elsewhere. So, you know, you had to allow me my Perfectos, because
that's what I thought I was
getting through this sort of starvation period.
There's a very funny business. There's a character named Marceline in Raymond Queneau's Zazie, and there is it's such a circus of a novel, and every time Marceline speaks, whatever she says, even if she's thoroughly enraged, the description said Marceline pensively, you know. Get out of my house, said Marceline pensively. Would you pass me the salt, said Marceline pensively. And there was a very funny quality that in this book there would be the meditative cigar, and it would have a kind of jus d'esprit quality existing nowhere else in the style.
Yes, you're quite right. And pensive is a funny word, I find. I sometimes say to my wife, I'm just going to have a pensive drink before I come to bed. And during times of great stress, I'd sometimes realize that I'd consumed a pensive half bottle of whiskey before coming, before staggering to that. Yeah. But despite the words of the poem, pensive, or because of it, pensive is a word we can't use seriously any longer, I don't think.
The other stylistic question I wanted to ask, the opening of Time's Arrow reminded me very much of Other People, a Mystery Story, where there too a division in consciousness, in fact, a rift so strong that the narrator there, I think a woman, is incapable of acknowledging certain experiences as having been her own. What is interesting to you about the division in consciousness?
Well, it's not quite a division. It's a way of making new, making strange. In other people, the narrator, a woman, or the main character, suffers from an amnesia so total that she doesn't know what a chair is, or a spoon, or a towel. So I have to find other ways of describing these strange things. And in this book, the world is made radically strange, so that ordinary actions have to be thought about again. I mean, many times when writing this book, I thought, how do we stand up? You know, do you put your arms on the chair and then lift? And how's it done? Rather like someone recovering from paralysis or something. You have to relearn basic human actions. There's a school of poetry and partly prose in England called Martianism, based on a poem by a friend of mine, Craig Raine, A Martian Sends a Postcard Home. Martianism, which also happens to be an anagram of my name, although that's fortuitous. And in this poem, he says things like, Model T is a room with a key inside. A lock is turned that frees the world for motion. So quickly there is a film to look for anything missed. Now that's just a description of a car, description of a toilet. Adults go to a punishment room. Only the young are allowed to suffer openly. Adults go to a punishment room with water but nothing to eat. They sit and suffer the noises alone, and everyone's pain has a different smell. Now, what I like about that is with water but nothing to eat. You know what I mean? Well, you miss the point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that poem wasn't just influential. It gave a name to something that was already there, hence the Martian school. But the more I read, you know, the more I reread, it occurs to me that every writer is a Martian. We're always trying to look at the world as if it's never been seen before. The reality most of us see is cooked. It's prepared. It's even nouvelle cuisine. The reality that writers see when they're on is raw. It's before it's all been put together and made sense of. And as the narrator of John Banville's last novel said, you know, I have never grown used to living on this planet. And that's what writing is not being used to it.
As an admirer of Nabokov and thinking about a world backwards, I guess I was ultimately surprised that the whole book wasn't a vast palindrome. I expected to have to read the whole backwards, but I think that probably would have taken too much time.
I think that would have been Silver Age work, too, as those very elaborate early Nabokov novels were, where, it, as you say, you know, it's a palindrome or whatever. Silver Age and Silver of the Bauble, not of the Knife.
A good enough definition, thank you. Thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books. Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with book of the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.